Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, who spoke before him, gave the opening address at the General Assembly. Trump said the two will meet soon. Trump said the two had, quote, excellent chemistry, saying it's a good sign. This comes after Trump imposed new 50% tariffs on Brazilian imports over the prosecution of former Brazilian president, Trump ally, Jair Bolsonaro. Earlier this month, Brazil's Supreme Court sentenced Bolsonaro to more than 27 years in prison for plotting a military coup after his election defeat in 2022. Trump also sanctioned the Supreme Court justice who led the probe into Bolsonaro, now as well sanctioned the judge's wife. President Lula opened the UN General Assembly just before Trump spoke.
There is no justification for unilateral and arbitrary measures against our institutions and our economy. The attack on the independence of the judiciary is unacceptable. This interference in internal affairs is aided by a subservient far right that longs for its former hegemony. Before the eyes of the world, Brazil sent a message to all aspiring autocrats and those who support them. Our democracy and our sovereignty are non-negotiable.
Ishan Tharoor, your final response on the significance of what Lula said.
Well, it was a very striking set piece to have Lula precede Trump, to have Lula almost directly attack the United States for its unilateral actions against Brazil. He spoke about the meticulous way in which the judiciary has operated in Brazil and the unfairness of the U.S. bullying of Brazil. He has spent many interviews telling us that if Trump was Brazilian, he would be under arrest and perhaps imprisoned for his role in the January 6, 2021 insurrection of the Capitol, and that it's a testament to Brazilian democracy, as opposed to American democracy or the American system, that Bolsonaro received the justice that he did. Now, if there's going to be some kind of softening or thaw, it's unclear. I have heard from the Brazilians that there are no immediate plans for Lula and Trump to meet. So whatever Trump touted from the General Assembly, it's a bit unclear if there'll be any follow-through from that.
Ishan Tharoor, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Global affairs columnist at The Washington Post will link to your pieces. Among them, Trump versus Lula was a window into MAGA at the UN, and a Trump-shaped wrecking ball swings toward a faltering United Nations. Coming up, we look at the Trump administration's claims about autism and vaccines. We'll look at Trump's war on science with Dr. Peter Hotez. Stay with us.
Who do you think you are? He plays us with his hate, turns man against man, but it's really not a game. And I pray to the ancestors' love, do not be fooled by this man's foolish talk. The serpent woke again in different times and places. There's a burning cross leading the mob, people in chains. He's a quack circus act creeping from the past. He's the symbol of the monster we no longer want to be. What we used to be. The earth trembles with his names, Mussolini, Adolf Hitler, Pinochet. No respect for woman, no respect for race. No.
The Demagogue by Lila Downs in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the subject of autism and false claims about the causes of autism made by President Trump and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at a news conference at the White House on Monday. President Trump, without evidence, linked autism to vaccines and said the combination MMR vaccine should be broken up into separate shots for measles, mumps, and rubella. But he couldn't remember the word rubella. Trump also recommended removing aluminum from vaccines and said parents should wait until their children are 12 to vaccinate against hepatitis B, falsely stating it's only transmitted sexually, which isn't true. So saying infants shouldn't have the Hep B shot, they should wait, when in fact it is transmitted through breast milk, in utero, and in the home. Trump also promoted the unproven claims that the common painkiller, acetaminophen, brand name Tylenol, causes autism in children if taken during pregnancy.
First, effective immediately, the FDA will be notifying physicians that the use of acetaminophen, is that okay?
Yes. Yes.
Which is basically commonly known as Tylenol, during pregnancy can be associated with a very increased risk of autism. So taking Tylenol is not good. All right, I'll say it. It's not good.
The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists called President Trump's remarks about Tylenol irresponsible, adding it's highly unsettling that our federal health agencies are willing to make an announcement that will affect the health and well-being of millions of people without the backing of reliable data. Dr. Helen Tager-Flusberg, founder of the Coalition of Autism Scientists, said, quote, "When the president of the United States makes claims like this, we know that many parents will be listening and the impact may be truly devastating," unquote. For more, we're joined by Dr. Peter Hotez, dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas, where he's also co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development. He's the author of several books, including Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. And his new book, co-authored with Dr. Michael Mann, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. Dr. Hotez, welcome back to Democracy Now! I want to reiterate that point that you're the father of an autistic daughter, as well as a scientist. If you can talk about this moment with President Trump stating one unproven fact after another, and talk about Tylenol, what we know and what we don't know.
Amy, it was 15, 20 minutes of complete fact-free news conference. I think, you know, the best way to approach this is to go back to first principles and understand what is autism and how does it come about. We've learned so much about autism, and I wrote about it in the book, which, by the way, came out. I wrote that book, Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, after a year of conversations with Mr. Kennedy. That was the product of that. And then we followed up this in the brand new book, Science Under Siege, with Michael Mann. But we know a lot about autism now. Autism occurs through the action of more than 100 different autism genes. So that's why we call it an autism spectrum, not just autism, because it's 100 different conditions of varying degrees of neurologic activity. All of these genes are involved in early fetal brain development. So we can explain the vast amount of autism just simply through the understanding of the genetics and understanding how these genes operate. Now, it doesn't mean that there's no environmental exposures or triggers, but it's operating through influencing autism genes early on in fetal brain development. The best example we know of a teratogen that, or something that will affect autism genes that will give an autism phenotype, is a medication called Depakote, otherwise known as valproic acid, which they didn't talk about at all. So if you're pregnant and not aware of it, and on that anti-seizure medication called valproic acid, valproate or Depakote, it'll interact with autism genes and give you and more likely than not could give you an autism phenotype. That looks pretty strong. And there are about half a dozen other chemical exposures that may do the same thing. And certainly not vaccines, because again, these are all events happening in early fetal brain development. So it's not just the massive evidence showing there's no link between MMR or thimerosal or alum or all the other things they say in autism, because it's happening in pregnancy. So there's no plausibility. But then let's get to Tylenol. Now, if, you know, of the half a dozen chemical exposures that look pretty strongly linked to autism and interacting with autism genes, Tylenol right now is not really on that list. Because about a year ago, there was a very large study done out of the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. And this is one of the top research institutes in universities in Europe. And it showed pretty clearly among those 2 million people enrolled in the study that there was no link between Tylenol and autism. There was a follow-up study of what's called a meta-analysis or a systematic review, where the study found some studies could show a link, others don't. Certainly worth following up on, not as high a priority from my point of view as the others, higher priority ones on the list. And if they held a news conference to say, look, we are interested in autism, we do think this is important for the health of the American people, we're going to convene the experts. We're going to convene some of the best neuroscientists, genetics experts, environmental health scientists, and bring them together to really pin down that complex interplay between autism genes and the handful of environmental exposures we know about further down the list. Well, we may also look at Tylenol. Fair enough. I think nobody would argue with that. But instead, what we got was, I call it fact-free, this specific laser focus on Tylenol, which doesn't make sense. And then the last thing I'll say is, again, the way they talk about autism in this such sort of baby terms and this very simplistic idea that we're going to find the cause of autism or the cure for autism, it rings hollow, because we know this complex interplay between autism genes, maybe some environmental exposures early on in pregnancy. It's like talking about any other complex condition. We wouldn't say, you know, for instance, we're going to find the cause of cancer, the cure of cancer. Nobody would accept that, because we know it's a complex interplay between oncogenes and the environment. So it was certainly an exercise in frustration for those of us in the scientific community.
Dr. Hotez, I wanted to ask you, how much of the rising rates in autism are the result of increased testing or recognition of the condition, and how much do you feel are real?
So that's a really important question, and it's a fair question to look at in more detail. Clearly, we've shifted how we diagnose autism. We used to call it autism. Now we call it autism spectrum disorder, and you have this whole very interesting discussion about neurodiversity that brings in a lot of bioethics issues. So starting in around the early 2000s, the American Academy of Pediatrics started asking pediatricians and recommended pediatricians to do autism screening between the first and second year of life. And guess what? The numbers went up. We also got better at diagnosing autism girls and women. We used to say it was 10 to 1 boys to girls. Now the proportions roughly 3 to 1. But as we get better in diagnosing autism in girls and women, because girls and women tend to camouflage their autism better, we often diagnose their comorbidities such as OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, or some of the eating disorders, it may even get closer to parity. We've also reached underserved schools in a better way. So we're diagnosing autism in the underrepresented minority community better. So all of that feeds into the likely explanation accounting for the steep rise in autism cases. Now, I do think there is an environmental component. And I remember having that conversation with Mr. Kennedy years ago. I'd say, look, Bobby, I can identify half a dozen chemical exposures like valproate. You're an environmental attorney. Hey, this is your sweet spot, man. You should be all over this and really look into it. At the time, he had zero interest. Now, you know, he comes along, you know, years later and talks about Tylenol, which, again, you know, is not what the science is telling us. So I do think there could be an environmental component to that as well. It should be looked into, but certainly not with the kind of rhetoric and the approach that this administration is proposing.
Let's go to Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recommending the use of leucovorin, claiming it improves verbal communication when given to children on the spectrum.
We have also identified an exciting therapy that may benefit large numbers of children who suffer from autism. Peer-reviewed literature has documented that up to 60% of folate deficient children with ASD and have improved verbal communications if given leucovorin. I have instructed NIH, FDA, and CMS to help doctors treat children appropriately. Jay will help tell that story, which started with sound science, the kind that restores faith in government.
So that's Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a man you know well. You spent a year talking to him. Your book about your daughter on the spectrum, Rachel, it also comes out of that. Explain what this is and what he's saying, and what does anecdotal versus evidence-based medicine mean?
So again, this is getting back to that first principle and why we started out this way, you know, 100 different autism genes, there are many different phenotypes. There are various subsets of kids and adults on the autism spectrum who have what are called autoantibodies to different components of their body. That some have antibodies to what are called glycosphingolipids, which is a type of a glycolipid. Others have autoantibodies to different membrane proteins. Some have what are called ANA antibodies, which you can also, anti-nuclear antibodies that you can find in lupus. And there is a subset that seems to have antibodies against folate receptor, which is a metabolite used for the synthesis of purines and pyrimidines in DNA. And perhaps for that subset of kids and adults, there could be some benefit for giving leucovorin, and there are even some studies to support that. And that's the way it needs to be framed. But again, it's always spoken about in these baby terms, right? Tylenol is the cause of autism. It's ridiculous. Or now leucovorin is going to be used as a major treatment. Again, what we need is better understanding, better, you know, precision medicine to really focus on the subgroup of kids and adults who may benefit from leucovorin.
And Dr. Holtz, in a broader sense, this war on science that the Trump administration has unleashed, all the cutbacks in research and the reductions of university research capacities, the doctors, many researchers fleeing to Canada or to Europe or Asia to be able to continue to conduct their research. What's the impact on the United States of this war?
Well, first of all, let's look at why this is happening. You know, Mr. Kennedy and this new version of Health and Human Services is very tied in with the wellness and influencer industry, and which, you know, a lot of it is built up whatever they can buy in bulk and jack up the price and then sell with $1,600 telehealth visits. I mean, if you ever wondered why they're all anti-parasitic drugs, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, fenbendazole, as we report in the book, it's because they're cheap, available in bulk. You can jack up the price and sell it with a $1,600 telehealth visit. But it also involves attacking mainstream science. That's why, you know, they attack vaccines. And that's why you heard Mr. Kennedy during our terrible measles epidemic that began in West Texas. You know, he says, well, yes, you can get the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or you can get this cocktail of supplements, budesonide and vitamin A and clarithromycin. You're scratching your head and say, where the heck does that come from? That's his pivot to the health and wellness and influencer industry. But part of that, tragically, is for the health and wellness influencer industry to sell their snake oil, they have to attack mainstream science. And the scientists then portray people like myself as cartoon villains or public enemies. And that means attacking the academic health centers. And they falsely allege that they're tied up with pharma companies and that sort of thing. And that's where the NIH funding cuts come. It's all to benefit. That's what the MAHA movement is. It's basically an economic stimulus plan for the health and wellness and influencer industry. And it's very damaging. And it's particularly tough for our young scientists who are just starting out. Sometimes I feel like they look at me in the desert, look at me like Moses in the desert. You know, why did you bring us here? And you have to, you know, find paths of light to carve through this, because it has made things very complicated. I still think you can, as we talk about in the book, Science Under Siege, you know, where there's urgency, but there's also agency, I do think we can find a path of light through this darkness, but it's certainly gotten more complicated.
We just have 30 seconds, Dr. Hotez, but I wanted to go back to this point where Trump says to pregnant people, just tough it out if your temperature spikes. What is the absolutely damaging message here when people who are pregnant are told that if their temperature spikes, this can damage the fetus? Tough it out. Don't take Tylenol.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as the I'm not an obstetrician, but if talking to my obstetrics colleagues, you know, one of the things that they're aware of is that just like certain harmful drugs such as Depakote has a harmful effect on the fetus, fever itself or some of the viruses that can cause the fever can have a harmful effect on the fetus. And so there may be a real downside from not taking Tylenol because we don't have a lot of options for pregnant women. You know, the obstetricians tend to avoid using aspirin or ibuprofen. So there's not a lot of choice out there. So to come out and just push Tylenol when the evidence for it is not there is completely reckless on my part. And I don't understand why the administration chose to do this.
Dr. Peter Hotez, I want to thank you for being with us, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor at Baylor College of Medicine. Among his books, his latest book is called Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. Coming up, President Trump signs an executive order calling Antifa a terrorist organization. Stay with us.
There's a man homeless and hungry. There's a wind that's hard and biting. There's a song in need of singing. There's a fuse in need of lighting. And it's no secret the day is coming. And it's a day I hope to see.
Freedom Ring, performed by Tom Morello for Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary. It was during the pandemic, and so he performed on Zoom. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how President Trump signed an executive order Monday that designates the anti-fascist movement, known as Antifa, as a domestic terrorist organization. Critics note the U.S. doesn't actually have a domestic terrorism law. The order reads in part, quote, Antifa is a militarist anarchist enterprise that explicitly calls for the overthrow of the U.S. government, law enforcement authorities, and our system of law, unquote. A 2020 Congressional Research Service report describes Antifa as a decentralized movement without a clear structure or leader. Antifa traces its roots both to anti-fascist movements in Europe and to opposition that formed during Trump's first term in office. Trump's new executive order also calls for the, quote, investigatory and prosecutorial action against financial supporters of Antifa. This is part of a wider attack on his critics that ramped up even further after the assassination of the conservative activist Charlie Kirk, even though law enforcement has made no links to Antifa and the alleged killer. For more, we're joined by Will Potter, award-winning investigative journalist, author who focuses on attacks on civil liberties in the name of fighting terrorism. His new book on factory farms and fascism is titled Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. He's also author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Will. Great to have you in our studio. Start off by responding to Antifa, the movement, being called a terrorist organization.
This is really a historic turning point and a radical escalation in the war on dissent and the war on protest. It's not about Antifa because Antifa is not an organization. I think what Trump is very clearly signaling here is it's using this as a catch-all to go against the broader left and anyone who speaks out against fascism right now, while at the same time giving continued unchecked authority to the FBI to ignore the rise of right-wing violence.
And Will, how is Charlie Kirk's murder being used by the Trump administration to attack the broader left in this country?
This is what fascists do. They deflect and misdirect. So they use opportunities like this to rewrite the narrative and then shift and blame their opposition and usher in, frankly, calls for violence and crackdowns. And I think we need to remember that even though there's no evidence linking Charlie Kirk's shooters to Antifa or any other left organization, they're going to proceed recklessly anyway. The intention is to capitalize on this, to crack down on their opponents, and to consolidate authoritarian power.
I want to go to Vice President Vance, who hosted Charlie Kirk's podcast after Charlie Kirk was assassinated, vowing to dismantle institutions and the political left that he claimed were promoting violence and terrorism.
Of course, we have to make sure that the killer is brought to justice. And importantly, we have to talk about this incredibly destructive movement of left-wing extremism that has grown up over the last few years, and I believe is part of the reason why Charlie was killed by an assassin's bullet. We're going to talk about how to dismantle that.
So can you talk about what Vance is talking about, how to dismantle this? He had Stephen Miller on, the White House advisor, who talked about going after what he called leftist organizations, left-wing organizations. And what are the historical antecedents for this, Will?
The historical precedent is when authoritarians say they want to destroy you and eradicate you, you need to listen. They're being transparent and open about their intentions. Historically, what we've seen in terms of political repression, as I've documented post 9/11, but also in broader historical timelines, is when these attacks start on the fringes or more organizations like Antifa or environmentalists or Black Lives Matter, it spreads more and more towards the center. And that's what Vance is indicating. This is not about fringe or radical organizations. This is about the mainstream left funding foundations and institutional support.
And Will, I just wanted to pivot briefly to your book, Little Red Barns. You say a 10-year investigation that you conducted of factory farms and fascism.
That's right. It was a. It has been a long journey, Juan, that started investigating factory farms as one of the top contributors to climate change and these repressive measures that are being used to silence journalists and to criminalize photography, and how that is spreading to other social movements. The connection to fascism is that as the FBI has relentlessly focused on environmentalists and animal activists, it's deliberately ignored the rise of far-right violence, and more broadly, it's facilitated it. Through informants and entrapment schemes. They're allowing this rise of white supremacist and far-right violence while they're focused on people taking photographs of animal cruelty.
Speak more about this. I mean, this is a 10-year investigation, really important, especially with this war on science. And you also talk about how animal agriculture is trying to discredit the whole issue of climate change as well.
It really amounts to what I would consider the authoritarian playbook post 9/11. It's about not only rewriting facts, but also censoring, misdirecting, pumping up fraudulent science like the oil industry and tobacco industry did for decades, but also shifting and embracing outright authoritarian tactics like criminalizing journalism, labeling civil disobedience as terrorism. Big agriculture has embraced all of this as a pathway to protect their profits and really keep consumers in the dark about what's happening.
Why did you single out photography? Just explain.
There is a wave of legislation that passed in multiple states in the U.S. called ag-gag laws that criminalize anyone, including journalists, who take photographs of factory farm cruelty and pollution and workers' rights abuses. And now that's spread globally as well.
Why the title Little Red Barns?
This is the foundational myth. This is the story we're all raised on of what a farm looks like. And it struck me in the investigation that this is also the foundational myth of fascism. When we hear Make America Great Again, we're talking about this return to an idyllic path, past that never existed. And this is what fascists have always done. They kind of create this mythology that we have to return to this golden era. And therefore, their attacks on dissent today are legitimized.
We clearly have to continue this conversation. We will, and post it at democracynow.org. Will Potter, investigative journalist, author of Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.